Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument in the estate of Pollock versus McMurray. From petitioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Bailey will present argument for petitioners, reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Robert Bailey representing the petitioner of the estate of Sheldon Pollock, deceased. During his lifetime, Mr. Pollock was sued by the respondent, Lorraine McMurray. Mr. Pollock filed an answer in that lawsuit, made demand that the suit be dismissed as to him because of a prior settlement that had been reached between him and Ms. McMurray. When that demand wasn't complied with, an amended answer was filed by Mr. Pollock and a counterclaim was filed by Mr. Pollock. Well, unfortunately, while the suit was pending before trial, Mr. Pollock died in an airplane crash in Arizona. Upon his death, the respondent caused a writ of sire facies to be issued and served on the co-executors of the estate, John Pollock and Eileen Pollock Erickson, two of the children of Mr. Pollock. No answer was filed. A default judgment was entered by the trial court. The estate timely filed a motion for new trial supported by affidavits and proper evidence, but the trial court declined to set aside the default judgment. The trial court was affirmed on appeal to the Court of Appeals. The petitioner contends that this was an abuse of discretion and that the default judgment should have been set aside and a new trial granted. Petitioner contends that it has met all three of the requirements set out by this court in the Sunshine Bus Lines versus Craddock case regarding default judgments and the setting aside of those default judgments. The petitioner also contends that the court abused its discretion by failing to give effect to the answers that had been filed by Mr. Pollock during his lifetime, and further contends that even if the requirements of Sunshine versus Craddock are not met, that those prior answers inure to the benefit of the estate and do not require an answer to be filed. We've cited in our brief for that proposition the estate of Puthers versus Holland Page Industries, which was an NRE case out of Austin Court of Appeals. And there the court noted that it's our opinion that the answer of decedent inures to the benefit of his legal representative and prevented a valid judgment by default under the facts of this case. The court then went on to cite a very early Texas Supreme Court decision that interpreted writs of sire facies and what the effect of writs of sire facies were. In that decision, this court indicated that the purpose of the writ of sire facies was simply to give notice to the estate and the estate's representatives so that they would come in and defend the suit. It was not actually the creation of a new action, and it was under that reasoning that the Austin court decided that the answer that had been filed did inure to the benefit of the estate, and that in the Puthers case it was error to have granted the default judgment in the face of that. Along the same lines, also cited in our brief, is the Houston Court of Appeals First District no writ case, the estate of Griffin versus Bostick.
You have, other than not discussing this, not resolving this issue, do you have any problems with the withdrawn per curiam of this court?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
Do you have any problems with the writing that we issued in this case?
No, sir. Do not. And in fact, I think the court was correct in the rationale that it used.
Could you address the issue of whether the respondent was denied improperly an opportunity to make discovery prior to hearing a motion for new trial?
It's my understanding that, yes, the respondent was not given the opportunity to take the depositions of John Pollock and Eileen Pollock Erickson. It doesn't appear in the record, and I don't want to argue outside of the record as to the rationale for doing so. I would point out to the court that on the issue of meritorious defenses, the case law indicates that if the defendant is able to establish prima facie meritorious defenses, then the trial court cannot consider controverting evidence to try to negate the prima facie established meritorious defense. Nevertheless, yes, Your Honor, the discovery was resisted.
How about if the same rule apply as to whether or not parties knew of a suit and were consciously indifferent in failing to answer?
No, sir, it does not. I don't believe that it does. I think that if I think that the according to the case law I've seen, the plaintiff is permitted to controvert the affidavits of the defendant as to whether conscious indifference or intentional disregard was present in the case. With respect to the resisting of the discovery, I do think that it would have been improper for the trial court to have precluded consideration of the two Pollock affidavits on that basis alone. I think it's much akin to the death penalty that this court has recently written about and the circumstances under which the death penalty should be imposed. I think one of the other objections that was raised to the affidavits of John and Eileen Pollock at the time of the motion for new trial was whether those affidavits were merely conclusory and based on information and belief. And I think a clear reading of the affidavits indicates that they are not conclusory. They state unequivocally that they were unaware that the suit had been filed. They state unequivocally that had they been aware that the suit had been filed, had they actually received notice of the suit through the Secretary of State, that they would have immediately forwarded those notifications to their California counsel to be handled.
But since those affidavits were unequivocal, that there was no need for discovery?
Your Honor, I can't defend what happened as far as the resisting of the discovery, but again, I think that if the sole basis for granting the objection to the affidavit was the resisting of the discovery, I think that is a death penalty. And I think it would have been inappropriate under the circumstances of this case.
The Court of Appeals has makes a statement with regard to the affidavit we're talking about, I believe. It states that neither affidavit adequately explains the client's failure to respond to appellee's suit. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think they do adequately explain it, Your Honor. Both John Pollock and Eileen Pollock Erickson stated that they did not receive any document to indicate that the estate had been made a party to the suit. And they both stated unequivocally that had they received such a document, they would have delivered it immediately to their attorney there in Los Angeles with the firm of Mallett, Lyons, Mallett, and Getzels.
Counsel, most of the case law in this area involved about not receiving notice of a suit involves service directly on a defendant,
yes,
or the registered agent of a defendant. This case, in this case, the Secretary of State was the deemed agent for your clients. Have you found cases that talk about the standard? I assume the Secretary of State would testify that he received notice of this suit. Have you found cases that discuss whether or not that is sufficient?
No, sir, I have not. I do think, though, that first of all, I think the estate is willing to concede that there was proper service on the estate. It was proper to serve the Secretary of State, as was done in this instance. I think the distinction that we want to make here, and hope that the court will understand, is that while the Secretary is agent in terms of constructive notice of the filing of the suit, when we're talking in terms of conscious indifference or intentional disregard, I think we move more into the realm of actual notice of the filing of the suit. And the affidavits established that there was not actual notice received by John Pollock and Eileen Pollock Erickson of the filing.
How can we accurately or adequately determine that in the absence of appropriate discovery of depositions?
I'm not sure, other than relying on the affidavits themselves, Your Honor.
Shouldn't we, instead of remanding as a per curiam, earlier per curiam did, instead of remanding for a new trial, wouldn't it be more appropriate for this court to remand it to the trial court with, for further proceedings on the motion for new trial, including instructions to the trial court to grant the appropriate discovery?
No, sir, I don't think so. And the reason that I don't believe that it should be remanded for that purpose is because of the previously filed answers by Sheldon Pollock during his lifetime. I believe the case law that we've cited to the court demonstrates that those answers do inure to the benefit of the estate, and that the mere service of a sire and facies does not require the estate to file an independent answer. It merely requires the state to come in, the estate to come in through its representatives and defend the action.
Have you looked at the law in other states?
No, sir.
On this area?
No, sir. I'd be happy to do so if the court would like for me to submit a supplemental brief.
I'm not demanding it. If you would like to file a supplemental brief, you may do so.
So the petitioner, the estate, does ask that the court reverse the decision of the trial court and court of appeals and remand it for a new trial. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Van McFarland presents argument for respondent.
Plaintiff McMurray, following the filing of the motion for summary judgment, noticed the deposition of each of the co-executors and one of their California counsel. They refused to submit to discovery. The trial court cited that refusal as one of the bases for denial of the motion for new trial. That issue was not raised in the Court of Appeals. McMurray, in her brief, pointed out that that issue had not been raised. No motion for leave to file a raise additional points was filed by the appellant, Hollis. That issue was not raised in the motion for rehearing. That point has not been raised until it has not been raised to this good day by the appellant, by the applicant. In the 3 years that have passed since this judgment was entered, we have a case in the First Court of Appeals, a case in the El Paso Court of Appeals, a case in the California Bankruptcy Court, and two cases in the trial court, all of which are based upon this, all of which have evolved out of this judgment. In fairness to the trial court and the Court of Appeals, if these rules are to mean anything, it is suggested that that issue should have been raised long ago. And it is not, it's a independent basis for affirming judgment that has not been overturned to this day. Are there any questions?
Can you speak to the per curiam that was issued by the court?
Yes, sir.
Your thoughts on the per curiam beyond what's in your brief?
Well, I can't agree with the findings of fact by the Court of Appeal with respect to the conversations with Sherman Lands, but if this court is going to be the finder of fact with respect to those, I have the affidavit which sets out the conversation that I had with Mr. Lands, who was co-counsel with respect to handling this matter. And I point out to the court that in that affidavit, along with the conversation with Beverly Mason, the attorney in charge, with the two conversations with Mr. Leahy, the other attorney, and with Mr. Lands, there was never any doubt that we were talking not about the California probate proceeding, but about the default judgment. Those words are used in the affidavit. The default judgment will be taken against the estate if a answer is not found. So, to that extent, I disagree with the court's referring to a point of law from your perspective.
Should the trial, how should we view the trial court's reliance on discovery abuse in declining to grant a new trial? Should it be measured by the same standard that by which a death penalty sanction is justified in the first instance, or different?
I'm sorry, I'm not able to speak to that.
Well, if you'd, after thought and research, if you'd like to supply us your thoughts in a supplemental letter brief, I'd be interested in that. I'm sure the rest of the court would be too, but you suggest the trial court's refusal to grant a new trial could be upheld on the basis of discovery abuse.
Yes, Your Honor, that is my position.
And I'm curious by what standard we ought to judge that. And if you would submit a supplemental letter brief on that, I'd be appreciative.
Very good.
Counsel, have you found any cases that deal with the issue of the of service on the Secretary of State and then a failure, and admittedly it was proper service, but then a failure of the defendant to answer, and what standard the defendant has to show in order to set that case aside? In other words, do you agree with opposing counsel that we're at the same actual notice standard that must be shown to meet the credit test?
I have not found a case. There is dicta, I believe. I'm sorry I cannot give you the cite, but it's dicta in one of the opinions of this court. To the effect that it seems to be saying that service has to be affected on the person and that service on the agent, the Secretary of State, is not yet good service. My concept, and I'm not able to give you authorities for it, but my concept was service on the Secretary of State is service, and the next step is notice. The opinion talks about service and not notice to the executors. And that is conceptually different than my traditional understanding of the process.
And one can show no actual notice, then one has met that prong of the credit test. No conscious indifference.
Well, provided that you haven't set up a process where you turn all matters of that nature routinely over to counsel without your mental process being involved. And I point out to the court that in the exhibit to the motion for new trial, there are two pages of lawsuits against Sheldon Pollock. They're listed. So perhaps the reference in the affidavits to their practice of routinely having that delivered to the law firm of Mallett, Lands, and et al. Perhaps that's the reference being made in the affidavits. So I agree with the court with the qualification.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
one other thing that I wanted to try to address from the question over on this side of the bench, if I recall correctly, the burden that the plaintiff has when the affidavit is controverted on the issue of conscious indifference or intentional disregard. I'd refer the court to one of its opinions on that issue. It was the Strachbein versus Pruitt decision in 1984, 671 Southwest 2nd, page 37. That decision was followed by the Waco Court of Appeals in a no-writ case at 695 Second 327. But the court here had said that when we're talking about conscious indifference or intentional disregard, you have to look to the knowledge and the acts of the defendant in trying to decide whether they so acted consciously indifference or with intentional disregard. Again, I believe the affidavits of John and Eileen Pollock demonstrate that they did not act with such conscious indifference or intentional disregard.
The Strachbein was a case where there was no controverting evidence.
That's correct, Your Honor. It was. However, the Waco Court of Appeals decision was one, I believe, where there was controverting evidence. And again, the court noted that you do need to look at what the knowledge and the acts were of the defendants in trying to decide that issue.
Here we really have an unexplained return of service, don't we?
Yes, sir. I believe that's correct.
Counsel, would you respond to opposing counsel's argument that your alternative grounds is waived?
Your Honor, I would like to address that both in the context of the evidentiary issue and I think in the context of the previously filed answer that I think had been raised by counsel in the motion for rehearing. And would refer the court to its decision in the Williams versus Caleb case, which at 802 second 651. There, the argument was waived or raised that Williams had waived error regarding the four-year statute of limitations and the relation back theory under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. But this court said that it's your practice to construe points of error liberally in order to adjudicate justly, fairly, and equitably the rights of the parties. We have a policy of permitting broader points of error, liberally construing briefing rules, and relaxing the past rigorous requirements as to the wording of points of error. When we take a look at what happened in the Caliph matter and compare it to what occurred in our case that's before the court today, certainly with respect to the previously filed answers, it's almost on all fours as being able, as the court's being able to address that. We did raise that in our motion or our amended application for writ of error. With respect to the evidentiary point itself, I think the same rules ought to be applied, Your Honor, so that there can be a full examination of the evidence in deciding whether the case ought to be remanded for a new trial.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument. The second call, and the court will now take.
The audience, please rise.